The Patriots show that the hyped-up Super Bowl rematch against the Atlanta Falcons was no rematch at all. We have special guest Albert Breer in studio today. You're going to want to hear his take on the Patriots and all things NFL. And the Red Sox, they finally get their man in the manager's office. It's Monday, October 23rd, 2017. I'm Chris Gasper, and this is Season Ticket. Welcome to Season Ticket, a daily podcast from the Boston Globe Sports Department and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The Patriots won on Sunday Night Football, beating the Falcons in what was billed as a rematch of Super Bowl 51. It was more like a mismatch. The Patriots won handily 23-7. Tom Brady tossed two touchdown passes. The Patriots' defense had its best game of the season. For the first time all season, they held a passer below 300 yards, as Matt Ryan, the quarterback of the Atlanta Falcons and reigning NFL MVP, only had 233 yards passing. Atlanta was not able to score until there was 4:09 left in the fourth quarter. Joining me now is Albert Breer. He is the senior football reporter for Monday Morning Quarterback. That's MMQB.com. You can also find him on NBC Sports Boston, 98.5 The Sports Hub. You can also hear him on the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. He is in studio with us today. Bert, thanks for joining us here on Season Ticket.
You got it, Chris.
So I want to start with the Patriots defense. I think that they were much maligned. A lot of people thought that the Falcons were going to put a lot of points on them. They didn't have Stephon Gilmore, their high-priced free agent cornerback signing. They didn't have Eric Rowe, another cornerback. Those were two of their top three cornerbacks. And they went out there and played their best defensive game of the year. They really were able to smother the Falcons. Is the Patriots defense for real? Is this progress for real? Or was this more about sort of the Falcons and their failures to execute on offense and struggling with new offensive coordinator Steve Sarkisian?
I certainly think there's a psychological element that the Falcons were dealing with last night. And you can see it in the way that their last three games went. They blew leads in each of those three games. Dan Quinn, their head coach, has been preaching aggression, 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 aggression. Last night, there's the 4th-and-7.
Well, are they really going to run this play? They are. So Ryan running around the outside, and he's going to get the first down. So how about Quinn on a 4th-and-7 from midfield?
And then later in the first half, the 4th-and-6, I thought was a critical play.
It's 4th-and-6, and Atlanta lines up to go for it, which they did on the 4th-and-7 in the first half. And they'll do it again. And Ryan throwing to the sideline, too high, incomplete. Sanu, the intended receiver.
The Patriots wind up turning a 10-0 lead into a 17-0 lead, where the Falcons could have just punted the ball away.
Yeah, right before the half.
Right, and then get the ball at the beginning of the second half. Maybe it's still 10-0 at that point. They can make it a one-possession game. It just felt like they were spooked. And I personally thought by now they would be by it. They aren't. That said, the Patriots played really well defensively. First, way more assignment sound. You're not seeing the breakdowns of communication. Last night we saw them play well in the red zone. We saw them mitigating damage. They played well on the third down. So that was one part of it. The other part of it, all of your investments in the secondary. And they need the secondary to play well.
You mean that's financial investment,
the
all the
financial
money.
Investment.
On defense.
Yeah, I mean, that's where they've invested. I think there's a talent issue in the front seven that's not going to be fully solved.
Yeah, the linebackers, the defensive line, probably not an upper echelon one. Dante Hightower's great, but a lot of the other guys, Trey Flowers is good, but it's certainly not the glory days of the Patriots.
And that's what you need. Like, where you invest, you need to be great. They've invested in the secondary. They have gambled that how well the secondary plays is going to allow them to be more creative up front to make up for the talent deficiency. I talked to Daron Harmon an hour after the game, and I brought that up. I brought up the money part of it. He's one of these guys who got paid, and he said, we understand a lot of this is on us.
Yeah, and Patriot safety, Daron Harmon, he's right. It is on him, and Devin McCourty, another safety there. And you mentioned something that was interesting to me, the red zone stuff. The Patriots had a big goal line stand in the fourth quarter there. They held Atlanta to 1-for-4 in the red zone. 3-of-12 on third down and fourth down. So that situational football that the Patriots have been known for that's sort of been lacking this year, we finally saw that. And it's so Patriots, too, to have a guy like Johnson Bademosi, who's a special teamer, a guy that's really just a journeyman in the NFL, who was pressed into action as the starting cornerback, a guy they picked up from the Detroit Lions right before the season started to play on special teams. He's out there covering Julio Jones, the star wide receiver for the Atlanta Falcons and one of the most explosive players in the NFL. Now, look, he had a lot of help, safety over the top, but he didn't embarrass himself out there. And that's what we're used to with the Patriots. But no matter who's out there, no matter what the personnel is, they find a way to execute. That's a hallmark of a Bill Belichick team.
You know, the big thing is, and this is one of the things that Bill is great at, he's fantastic at assessing the people in his own building. And that goes for coaches. That's one of the reasons why a lot of the coaches who've gone other places have struggled, is because he is able to cover up for their weaknesses. And so remember that old clip from A Football Life when, and this is from the 2009 season, where he's standing on the sideline with his arms crossed and he's with Brady.
In
New
Orleans. And
they're getting blown out by New Orleans.
I just can't get this team to play the way we need to play. I can't do it. So frustrating.
The first month of the season felt like that to me. Like, the problems that they had talent-wise on defense were being exacerbated by guys being out of position, guys not doing what they're told to do. And one of the things about somebody like Bademosi is Bill knows I need to give him a if I'm going to put him out there on Julio, I need to give him a ton of help. And it's up to Bademosi to go out there and play knowing I have that help and not trying to overdo things. And so I think that's a huge part of this is – he understands his talent. He understands how to use it. It's getting the players to do what he's telling them to do, which isn't always easy.
Yeah, no question about that. So as we mentioned, we're talking about this game, a rematch of Super Bowl 51. And that game gave Tom Brady his fifth Super Bowl title and fourth Super Bowl MVP. Brady's having a great season this year, Bert, but he's a little banged up with a shoulder injury. Is this something that is going to be with him throughout the rest of the year, this shoulder injury? And is there something else there maybe in terms of an injury with Brady that he's dealing with that might be affecting his performance a little bit?
My understanding was the shoulder thing. Now, I know the AC joint sprain was what got out in the news, but it wasn't so much that as it was an accumulation of a couple different things where he was dealing with some soreness in his shoulder. And look, he's 40 years old. And so for Josh McDaniels and that coaching staff, it's about finding a way to limit the amount of damage that he takes. And that's why the shoulder injury was alarming, because it happened early in the year and he was already taking a lot of hits, and they've got different types of weapons now. They've always had the shorter jitterbug receiver who can get open really quickly. Well, now in bringing in Philip Dorsett and bringing in Brandon Cooks, you've got the down the field type weapon who takes longer to uncover. And for Brady early in the year, that meant he was taking some hits. And I think Josh and the coaching staff understood we have to do some things to make sure that we're limiting damage on him. And I think they've done that the last couple of weeks. You certainly saw it in the Bucs game where they were getting the ball out quickly to James White and Danny Amendola. And I think there's been more of an effort since then to try to get the ball out of Brady's hands quicker so he's not taking those hits.
So when you look at the Patriots now, they've played seven games, Bert. They're 5-2. Let me paint the picture for you. Three-way tie at the top of the AFC East. At 5-2, the New England Patriots, the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Kansas City Chiefs. In your opinion, who's the best team in the AFC right now, and who will be the best team at the end of the season? I think it's the Patriots.
I still think the Patriots are the favorite. I think the team to watch is Pittsburgh. Now, I know Kansas City's played really well on balance, and look, they lost a close one on the road on a Thursday night to Oakland. Now they've kind of come back to the pack because they've lost two in a row. The reason I think Pittsburgh's a team to watch, we've all made a lot of Ben Roethlisberger, their quarterback, and Antonio Brown. But what I think a lot of people have missed is the defense is slowly getting better. And it's been a long process for them coming out from underneath that last great wave of defensive stars, Troy Polamalu, Ike Taylor, James Ferrier, Aaron Smith. The defense won that game in Kansas City two Sundays ago. And I think what we're seeing now is a group of young players that's playing with more confidence. Keith Butler's in his second year as the defensive coordinator now. And it looks, at least to me, like finally all the draft capital they've spent on the defensive side of the ball seems to be paying off.
Yeah, I would say the Steelers as well. I think the Steelers are the biggest threat to the Patriots. They're their team with the highest ceiling. I think the Steelers have more raw talent than the Patriots, but I think the Patriots with Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, they have that advantage in terms of the institutional knowledge, the winning. I know Ben Roethlisberger and Mike Tomlin, you know, have won a Super Bowl. Roethlisberger's won two. But I just think when push comes to shove, and you saw it in the AFC Championship game when Pittsburgh had to come here last season, the Patriots have an advantage here. All right, we're going to take a brief time out here on Season Ticket. When we come back with Albert Breer of the MMQB, we're going to talk about some NFL issues, some issues around the league, including the national anthem protest. That's coming up. Welcome back. A quick note, if you like Season Ticket, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, or if you have an Android phone, check us out on Stitcher or Google Play. Subscribing is the best way to make sure you get the latest episode as soon as it's available. We're back now with Albert Breer of the MMQB. I want to ask you about the national anthem protests that have been going on. Roger Goodell met with players about this issue. There really was not a resolution. NFL policy is that players should stand for the anthem. It's not that they must stand for the anthem. Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones has gone on the record and said that his players must stand. If they don't, they won't play. He also said this past weekend that he thinks these protests are hurting the league, hurting the product, and making fans less likely to watch. Do you agree with him?
I don't think there's any question that it's affecting business. Maybe not at the fan level, but absolutely at the sponsor level, at the advertiser level.
That matters even more, right?
That's more important. And I don't think Jerry was talking to his players at all, and he communicated that to them. He was talking to the sponsors, he was talking to the advertisers, and as much as anything else, he was talking to his fans in Texas. And the message he gave his players was, we're in business with you. You literally take a percentage of what we make. No matter what side of this you stand on, we know this is not good for business. I think that was a large part of the discussion last week in New York when the group of players met with 11 NFL owners. We need to find a way to resolve this, and we need to take the discussion off the anthem protest and on to the causes that all of you guys are trying to serve by protesting. My understanding coming out of that meeting was it was as good, strong dialogue as they've had between owners and players in a long time. Now, God knows that that can blow up and go in the wrong direction at any moment because of where player-owner relations have been in the NFL over the last 6 years. But it was a good start. And I think that the focus now is let's move it to the message you guys are trying to get across, and let's do things that advance the causes and that advance the discussion somewhere else. Now, Donald Trump tweeted something else this morning. It's a great example of the tact I think they're going to take with it going forward. They're going to try to ignore him. And it's, that sounds crazy because he's the president of the United States, but their strategy, I think, going forward is, okay, you did what you did in Alabama, and that was an absolute neutron bomb because it was the president of the United States calling out NFL players. But now you've done it like every day for the last 3 weeks, so it sort of loses its effect. And I think what their hope is now is that they'll be able to ignore this going forward. And guys who want to protest can still protest, but they don't want it to be a news story every single week because that's not good for business.
It's not about respect for the anthem for Jerry Jones. It's about revenue. And in his mind, revenue for the NFL trumps the First Amendment rights of his players. Mm. And that's the appeal he's making. And that's what I've said about this from the beginning. You know, the Jerry Jones of the world, and even Stephen Ross in Miami, the owner of the Miami Dolphins, who another team that is saying their players must stand for the anthem. If you don't, you know, you can remain in the tunnel. For them, this is not about patriotism for these guys. It's about capitalism. Right. And Trump has hurt them where it hits home the most, which is their egos saying they can't control their players and their wallets. That's what's interesting if I'm a player. I look at it and say, yeah, you're making a very good business case to me, Jerry. But ultimately, I think this comes down to, in your mind, from a moral standpoint, making money trumps any of my rights as an American, and it's all about the business.
That's how he's trying to appeal to them.
That's how he looks at it.
As businessmen. This isn't ideological for Jerry Jones. The only church that he's praying at here is the U.S. Mint. Like, that's the only thing. Like, and I've covered the guy on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, you were down in Dallas.
I mean, he can sell ketchup to a woman in white gloves. Like, he always thinks with the bottom line in mind, and look, you can call this disingenuous, but what he actually said to the players was, I'm trying to take the burden off of you by taking the choice away from you. And I think you could certainly argue that he did that the reverse happened, which was it put pressure on the players to react because they may be seen as a sellout if they don't protest in that situation. So obviously it's complicated.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a complicated issue for the league. Now, I want to go to the man that started these protests last year by first sitting and then taking a knee for the anthem, and that's Colin Kaepernick. He did that last year when he was the quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. He opted out of his contract after the season. He has not been signed by any NFL team. He is currently suing the NFL because he feels like he has been sort of exiled from the league and blackballed here. Are we any closer to him getting back in the league? You look at the quarterback position around the NFL. Mm-hmm. Jay Cutler just got hurt in Miami. Aaron Rodgers is out with the Green Bay Packers, and Brett Hundley, his backup, really, really struggled. The Indianapolis Colts season seems to be circling the drain. Andrew Luck is no closer really to returning there, and former Patriots quarterback Jacoby Brissett, he's played well, but even he would need some sort of backup. Is there any logical place at this point where Kaepernick could land, or is this status quo and he'll just be watching at home like us?
I'm going to say there's almost no chance, at least right now, that he winds up on a team this year. There are layers to this. I think it begins with the deterioration of his play. If Cam Newton started this, or if Russell Wilson started this, or if Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers started this, they'd be on rosters. The way the NFL works is that baggage sounds like a harsh way to put it, but your talent has to justify your baggage. And unfortunately for Colin Kaepernick, his talent is here, and then the baggage, as NFL teams see it, is up here. And that's a huge part of the issue.
I just think it's funny NFL teams see protesting against social injustice as baggage.
Well, but this is a coach being worried about like Fox News and CNN, and as short-lived as that might be, you might be dealing with it for a few days. I got killed for making this comparison, but in a certain way, it's the same thing as Tim Tebow dealt with. Tim Tebow didn't really do anything wrong, but the circus followed him around. And there was just that element of it, and a lot of teams looked at it and said, you know, maybe I give him a shot, but I don't want to deal with that. There's also the scheme element, of course, too, which is that he doesn't fit everyone's offense, which necessarily
which is a fair point.
Which necessarily cuts down the number of suitors.
Now he's jumping into somebody's offense in the middle of the year.
Yeah, I think that's a central problem, is that, like, if I'm going to take on all of this, what's my return?
Yeah, but, I mean, let's be clear, though. I mean, if he, you know, the baggage, if you want to call it that, and again, I don't see it that way.
I know what you're saying.
So he would be, he's talented enough to be in the NFL.
Yeah,
there's no question about it. And I think
there are lots of guys who are, look, Jay Cutler. Why didn't Jay Cutler get a job as a backup? It's not because he wasn't good
needed
enough.
The right system.
Well, not, it's because he's a jerk. Those sorts of things come into play with backups or guys who might be replacement level starters.
Yeah, I also think it just sort of speaks to football culture, though, the old trope these guys have about, well, this is a distraction. And the message of that is that, you know, you are a football automaton and all you're supposed to do is focus on football and you're not supposed to have any interest outside of football. I'll tell you what, for a lot of these players, and you mentioned the Jerry Jones thing, it doesn't matter how much money they have. There's no amount of money that makes them immune to social injustice in America. And that's why these guys have a different point of view from Jerry Jones. And also just the NFL culture that sort of says, you know, hey, look, you using your First Amendment rights here and protesting against inequalities in the American justice system, this is a distraction for us. But on the other hand, we'll take this guy in Greg Hardy over here who is abusing women because he's really still a good player and can sack quarterbacks. There's a hypocrisy
has
to confront.
The video comes into play with it, but why did Greg Hardy get a job and Ray Rice didn't?
Because Greg Hardy could still play.
Was a much better player.
Absolutely.
And I will take this to my grave. The reason why Ray Rice didn't get a second chance after everything that happened, and you could never make up for something like that, but he worked really hard to try to rehabilitate his image. The reason he never got a second chance is because his last year in the NFL, he averaged 3 yards a carry.
Yeah, and I think that's why the players, you know, look, Roger Goodell said, we support the players and their cause in terms of the social justice after the meeting. We want to be supportive of them. We want to work together. If I'm the players, to me, it's like in the NFL, when you're out in the field, actions speak louder than words. I wouldn't necessarily believe the NFL because NFL culture says otherwise. It says they're always going to value the bottom line and pure football over helping with
social
issues.
I'll tell you what, Chris. It's interesting because I talked to a player who was in that room who said the exact same thing you did, which was, that was great. Talk is nice. Action's a lot harder.
Yeah, you haven't seen it from the NFL. I want to hit on a couple more things with you here very quickly, Bert. One, you had this on the MMQB. NFL ratings this year are down.
Yep.
Down 7.5% overall. The NFL's average household rating is currently 25.1. That's down from 26.9 over the same period last year. The teams' ratings in their local markets are down, including the Patriots. Patriots' ratings were down 8% going into the game Sunday night. How worried is the league about this, and what do you attribute it to?
Well, let's put into context first that this is a problem that's not just specific to football. It's all of television. Every sports league's dealing with this. Non-sports television is dealing with this at an even higher level than sports television is. So this isn't something that's specific to the NFL. That said, this is a league that is so used to having everything that it touches turn to gold.
They think they're bulletproof.
For so long, they were immune to so many of the issues that other sports leagues had. They were immune to so many of the issues that other forms of entertainment had. And I think, like, the attention span of young people, their willingness to sit on a couch for 12 hours on a Sunday and watch, that's changed. The way people are consuming content has certainly changed. People are cord-cutting. I think that affects the audience. So they're dealing with the same things that a lot of other forms of entertainment and certainly sports entertainment are dealing with. And now they've got a television contract coming up in 4 years that may not look anywhere close to the same as this one does. And is it going to affect whether they go to Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or Google instead of going to ABC, NBC, CBS, ESPN, Fox? It's fascinating because they aren't going to pull back on all the goals they've had from a revenue standpoint. But so much of their revenue has come from television. So much of their success is tied to television. Now, for the first time in forever, that upward trajectory that everything that they put on the air has been on forever isn't there anymore. And so there are certainly some challenges, again, facing the same challenges that everybody else is, but it's new for the NFL because they've just never dealt with a decline like this.
Yeah, I mean, the NFL, I think they always thought that, you know, Sir Isaac Newton didn't apply to them. You know, what goes up must come down.
The rules do not apply to them.
They thought it was just going to keep going up, 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 and that's clearly not the case. Something to keep an eye on. All right, that's Albert Breer of the MMQB. He's one of the best NFL reporters you'll find, and also my good friend. We'll have to have you back, and another time we can tell some stories. We'll tell the ones that can go on the air, Bert, okay? You can find him on Twitter, at Albert Breer. He is a prolific tweeter. We have this little note here, Bert. You've tweeted 85,000 times since 2009, and he's probably tweeting right now. Bert, thanks for joining us. Moving on, we're going to talk about the Red Sox here. They have a new manager. Over the weekend, they named Alex Cora the 47th manager in Red Sox history. Cora is certainly a familiar face for Red Sox fans. He played on the 2007 World Series championship team. He was here from 2005 to 2008 as a player, a utility infielder. He's currently a coach for the Houston Astros, who are making a World Series appearance here the second time the Astros have made it to the World Series. That means we're not going to get a press conference from Alex Cora, but the Red Sox did go and name him their manager. He's the first Hispanic manager in Red Sox history, which I think is significant given the breakdown demographically in Major League Baseball today, and also when you look at the Red Sox clubhouse. He was really the number one choice of the Red Sox here for everything they talked about in terms of wanting an experienced manager. But I think Cora was always the guy for the Red Sox. He played here. He understands the market. He was a media member for ESPN. Again, he's bilingual, which is something that is appealing to them. He's worked in a front office capacity in the Puerto Rican Winter League. He's a native of Puerto Rico. He is good with analytics. He really checks all the boxes for a modern manager here. He's not that far away from his playing career. He's only 42 years old. The veteran players still remember him. There's probably guys that faced him. David Price probably faced Alex Cora as a player. So that's somebody that he will respect. So look, on paper, this looks like a slam dunk hire. But that's the thing about the Red Sox managerial job, right? It always looks like a slam dunk hire. Remember all the pomp and circumstance for John Farrell when he came here? He was the perfect choice. But it still ended sort of on a sour note. So a lot of excitement, obviously, for the Red Sox with Alex Cora. But he has a lot of work ahead of him, more work than you would expect for a team that is back-to-back American League East champions and had back-to-back 93-win seasons. They're expecting a lot from Cora. They want him to win right away, a la Terry Francona. So he should be happy to have the job, but I'll be honest, I don't envy him because it's a very difficult job. that he now has. We're going to talk more about this tomorrow on Season Ticket. We'll also preview the World Series, which begins on Tuesday as the Los Angeles Dodgers host the Houston Astros. That's going to do it for today. Remember, if you liked us, be sure to tell a friend and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Season Ticket is a production of the WBUR iLab and the Boston Globe. For more great stories, subscribe to the Boston Globe. I'm Chris Gasper. We'll see you tomorrow.